Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is G. Kevin Fasick from the law firm of Cooch & Taylor. I represent the appellant, Martin C. Meltzer. This is an appeal of the Superior Court's grant of summary judgment on all nine counts of the plaintiff's complaint. Our argument centers on the fact that, or our contention, that the court did not consider the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, and additionally, that the court did not consider a number of counts that were raised in Mr. Meltzer's complaint, specifically due process, the city whistleblower statute, and the workers' comp retaliation statute. With respect to due process, as we've set forth, Mr. Meltzer, in the summer and into the fall of 2008, was suspended without pay or benefits for a period of over 2 months in violation of the city's policy and procedure manual. It is undisputed that this manual applies to all city employees. It is also undisputed that the manual creates a property interest in Mr. Meltzer's employment, as it does with all city employees.
Excuse me. Yes, Your Honor. Did he then get paid back afterwards when the matter was resolved?
That is correct, Your Honor. Upon the completion of the suspension period, I believe in October of 2008, Mr. Meltzer was reinstated and he did in fact receive back pay.
So what is the harm that has been done to him?
Well, Your Honor, I think the focus with respect to that is the mere fact that due process was violated. Mr. Meltzer received no progressive discipline, no prior discipline prior to being suspended.
What relief are you looking for on that claim?
Well, Your Honor, during the period Mr. Meltzer was suspended, he was forced to tap into his savings, which worked a significant economic hardship. It also increased pressure and anxiety on Mr. Meltzer, who the defendants knew was someone who had a heart condition and had previously been treated for that condition. Your Honor, with respect to this, I think there are also certainly claims for punitive damages with respect to this. And I think the focus with...
Have you made a claim for punitive damages?
Punitive damages is included in the claim for relief, yes, Your Honor. I think the focus with respect to the due process issue, Your Honor, is what sort of precedent would be set if, in this case, the city...
Your position, yeah, as I understand it, is even though he received back pay, his deprivation of due process is a wrong that independently entitles him to damages above and beyond back pay. Is that right?
That would be correct, Your Honor. Yes, thank you.
And punitive damages, if the criteria for punitive damages are satisfied.
That would be correct, Your Honor.
Isn't it the case that the suspension without pay was a problem that was self-created? It was done, we are told, because and only because Mr. Meltzer didn't get an ethics opinion from the Bar Association Committee, didn't do that for 6 months, decided to choose his own, arbitrator, and the city wouldn't accept that. And so it was only after the city took this step that Mr. Meltzer did what he had been told he had to do 6 months before?
Well, you are correct, Your Honor. And with respect to the issue...
Why do you have a due process issue here and any cognizable claim for damages when all of this could have been avoided if Mr. Meltzer had simply gone to the Bar Association Committee to begin with?
Well, Your Honor, I think there are a couple of issues with respect to that. The first one being that regardless of what the infraction, if I may use that word, is, whatever Mr. Meltzer did that could have or potentially should have subjected him to discipline, he did not receive the due process that is set forth both in the city code and also in the city's policy and procedure manual. Policy 206.1.
That presupposes that this was discipline. The argument made by the city is that it was not discipline. that it was a unique set of circumstances created because Mr. Meltzer was both the legal advisor to the city and litigant against the city at the same time.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not quite sure how one could characterize a 2.5 or 2+ month suspension as being anything other than disciplinary. And I think in this circumstance, whether
is that an argument?
Well, I think that it could be, Your Honor, absolutely. I think that regardless of what the infraction was, Mr. Meltzer was entitled to some form of progressive discipline.
Discipline is an official response to some violation of a rule.
Correct.
Some work-related rule or standard.
I agree.
This doesn't necessarily fit into that category at all. So when you say you can't imagine any characterization of this other than discipline, that may be overstating it, would it not?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I don't know that I can agree with that. If we take a look at the employer in this instance, told the employee to take a certain path, do a certain task, what have you, the employee declined to do so. And I think backing up a moment, would ask the court to recognize that Mr. Meltzer didn't simply say, no, I'm not going to do this. When faced with this request,
he didn't do it.
He didn't do it, Your Honor.
He wasn't going to do it. Doesn't matter, does it? He didn't do it.
Well, I think looking at the fact that when the city made the request, and an exclusive request, as the court below recognized, we responded to that by providing case law, providing some authorities that, in our contention, established that requesting this opinion was not necessary, that it was something that didn't need to be done. We obtained the counsel of an expert on this issue and submitted an expert opinion.
What difference does it make whether it was necessary? That is, whether a lawyer thinks it's necessary. The city is his employer, and the city thought it was necessary.
Well, and Your Honor, I would have to say there that our contention was looking at it as a legal issue, and whether or not a Delaware lawyer placed in this position would be required to go through and get the ethics opinion, we simply felt that it was something that was not necessary. I feel we established that very conclusively.
All right, you thought it wasn't necessary, you being your client. And so he went on and disregarded what the city specifically told him to do, and that brought on a suspension without pay until he got the opinion, and thereafter he received back pay. How can we conclude that the Superior Court erred as a matter of law in dismissing that claim?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that, again, underneath it all, Mr. Meltzer should have been entitled to due process. In addition, when he was...
What process was due?
Well, Your Honor, under the manual and the code, Mr. Meltzer, in fact, requested a due process hearing from the city with respect to this suspension. That request was simply ignored. There was never any response to it. In the interim, the opinion was secured, so essentially that became moot once he was reinstated. However, I think in a situation here where the employer makes a request that the employee feels, and again, taking the specific circumstances that we're talking about here, that we felt, given the case law, given the authority, we believed, based on our research, that this was something that was not necessary, that Mr. Meltzer returning to work for the city as an assistant city solicitor would not violate Rule 1.7. We found authority on this point, sought the advice of an expert.
So you're saying that unless there was some legal requirement that Mr. Meltzer go to the Bar Association Committee, he could do whatever he wanted And if the city responded the way it did, that's a due process violation.
Well, I think, again, in this situation, the fact that we presented our argument to the city, requested some contrary authority, some contrary position.
Is that a yes or a no?
Well, I think it's a difficult one for me to respond to, Your Honor. I would have to say no under these circumstances. I think under the specific circumstances that we're dealing with
here. Well, if that's the case, then your position is necessarily, as a matter of law, that the Superior Court erred in concluding that there was no due process violation and dismissing the claim. If that's the case, then there has to be a rule of law that we would have to articulate in an opinion to express to your to all the litigants and to the public the reason why the court erred. What would be the rule of law?
I think, Your Honor, in this instance, that the fact that there is a property interest in the employment, there are due process protections, provisions for progressive discipline, provisions for hearings, a due process hearing. These are all things that are set forth in the Policy and Procedures Manual and the code. The fact that the city in this instance completely disregarded
those discipline.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
All of which presuppose that you're in a disciplinary track, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. And again, I have to contend that a 2.5 month suspension is nothing but disciplinary.
Let me give you a hypothetical. Let's
Certainly,
say an employer, any employer, has an employee and has some concern about whether the employee has some sort of contagious illness. And the employer says, listen, if you've got an illness, we don't want you coming to work. And we need you to go to your doctor and come back and let us know whether you've got a contagious disease or not. And the employee says, well, I know that I don't have a contagious disease, and so I'm not going to get you that. Why would the employer be wrong in saying, under those circumstances, we're going to suspend you until you give us the assurances that we need for the workplace?
Well, Your Honor, leaving aside for a second, the question is somewhat fraught with perils under the Americans with Disabilities Act. I think I understand where the court is going with this. I think if an employer, and bearing in mind that in this situation we have a government employer, which essentially there are different standards for public and private, but if an employer, any employer in that circumstance, had a concern that related to, if I may, forgive me for rephrasing the question somewhat, a concern that could affect the safety and well-being of the workplace, of the other workers, of the customers, of the public. I think in that circumstance where you have a heightened issue, a safety concern, that I think an employer, again, leaving aside the Americans with Disabilities Act issues where with regard to regarded as or perceived as being disabled, I think if the employer is aware of a known and has a credible basis for saying we believe there is a safety concern here, they can address that circumstance.
And isn't this, granted, it's not a perfect analogy, but isn't this a similar circumstance where the employer isn't just saying, well, we've decided to suspend you because we want you to get this ethics opinion. We've got no reason to want you to have an ethics opinion, but we do anyhow. You're not getting it. We're suspending you. That's not what happened. The employer had a concern that I think you've pretty much acknowledged was not a baseless concern. It may have been inaccurate, but it was a legitimate concern, was it not?
Well, Your Honor, I won't disagree with that statement. However, I believe that when again, looking at the facts here, Mr. Meltzer had originally filed his claim, his charge of discrimination, a year prior to this demand being made. The city was well aware for a year that he was going to be returning, and they did nothing. They did not make the demand until he was returning to the city and filed his complaint. I noticed that I'm in the rebuttal time. If I may, I reserve the remainder of my comments for the rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Williams?
May it please the court. Mr. Fasig suggested to the court that the city's request for an ethics opinion was not necessary. In fact, if you look at the opinion issued by the advisory committee, Mr. Meltzer's position was, I can return to work without any limitations on what kind of work I perform. The committee said, first, this is an unsettled issue of law, which is why the city had a concern. And secondly, said, when he returns, you need to restrict his activities. You can't work on matters that overlap with the kinds of issues that are in the lawsuit.
But as the Superior Court pointed out, the city had some other ways to deal with this. For example, they could have simply said, you know, we're not going to assign you to legal work. Now, I suppose the city doesn't want to pay someone for being a lawyer if they're not being a lawyer. But this seemed kind of the extreme way to deal with it, simply say, don't come to work, you're not getting paid until we get the opinion.
Well, Your Honor, I would not agree with Your Honor that it was extreme. I think it was that the employees staked out a rather extreme position.
I don't want you to be hung up on my use of the word extreme. This was the most significant or severe way to handle it. If you looked at a hierarchy of ways to deal with this perceived conflict, they picked the one at the highest level. They didn't pick, as the Superior Court said, any alternative. Is there something higher they could have done? I guess they could have fired him.
Well, yes, Your Honor. And to bring him back and to restrict his activities as a lawyer without the benefit of the advisory committee opinion, I think would have resulted in a claim that we were retaliating. And so they were very sensitive to that. And the fact of the matter is that they started these requests back in January. He was on leave with the U.S. Attorney's Office, working at the U.S. Attorney's Office. In February, when he was about to return, in the meantime, the city requested the opinion. The advisory committee said no. The affected lawyer must request the opinion. So they were stuck with that. And then in the meantime, while they thought they were going to get an opinion from the advisory committee, they put him on a paid leave in February. Then they kept repeatedly asking him to do this. And at the end of the day, they were faced with a situation where they just permit him to return to work on his terms and have him disregard the request.
How long was he on the paid leave?
He was on a paid leave, I think, Your Honor, for a few weeks in February. But in advance of even going to the U.S. Attorney's Office, the city had agreed to give him a 10-week sabbatical leave with half pay at his request. So it was just a short time in February. Then he went on a sabbatical leave that the city granted to him, and then it was July when he was ultimately scheduled to come back. So it was a self-created hardship entirely. Yet there's plenty of time to get this opinion.
Is there any reason in the record to reflect why the city didn't schedule his grievance, for want of a better term?
Well, because the city didn't view this as disciplinary. The city had no desire to discipline Mr. Meltzer. I guess they could have looked at it from the framework of saying, we're going to initiate a disciplinary process for insubordination. But again, the city is faced with an employee. He works there as we speak.
No, I understand.
And they're sensitive to anything that smacks of retaliation. And so the city had no desire to discipline him. It simply wanted an advisory committee opinion.
We're only trying to understand the record. The claim is due process. We know one element of the claim. We heard about that at length in the opening. But here, if somebody files a grievance, it's represented to our court that he never got an answer. If the city took the view, we're not disciplining you, you would think they could write a letter in a week that says, you know, your request for a grievance is denied because you're not being disciplined. but it's represented to us, he got no answer. It was simply not responded to.
Well, I think he got no answer, Your Honor. Well, I understand Your Honor's point, and perhaps in hindsight it would have been prudent to write such a letter. But the letter that put him on notice of what they were going to do, I think made it clear that this wasn't disciplinary. He's the one that wanted to characterize it as disciplinary.
So if I understand correctly, your response to an earlier question by Justice Holland, it may be that the suspension without pay was extreme in the sense that that it fell short of the ultimate response, which would be just firing Mr. Mouser. But nonetheless, it was reasonable given the circumstances and given the fact that Mr. Meltzer was a lawyer someone who could rightfully be expected to adhere to the appropriate ethical standards.
Absolutely correct, Your Honor. Really at the heart of this case is this promotional claim. That's what triggered the lawsuit, and then we had a look back to see if we could find some protected activity, to see if we could find some adverse employment action, and that was part of the problem going forward. Mr. Meltzer continued to really search for adverse employment action. I would respectfully submit that this whole argument on the ethics opinion is a bit of a bootstrap, because I think he was inviting the city to take some adverse employment action.
Let's talk about the promotion issue. Was this strictly an in-house promotion opportunity?
Yes, Your Honor. There are 10 lawyers in the department.
My question is simple. It was advertised only in-house.
Right.
And I would not qualify because I never worked for the city. I never had 3 evaluations. So when the preamble to this position says we're looking to attract and retain, what you're really talking about is attract them into the city and retain them through this opportunity. But the opportunity was only available in-house.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the city attorneys are woefully underpaid, even compared to the other public agencies. So they were looking for an opportunity to a title, a little bit of an increase in order to retain and then, create that possibility of some more promotional opportunities, hopefully would also work to attract. But this was only open to these two promotional opportunities were limited to the existing members of the department.
Well, Mr. Meltzer's argument is by picking 3 years, the city excluded him. If you would have picked 1 year, let's not get into the years. His argument is one of the criteria excluded him, and it was known when that criteria was put in there that he was excluded. Isn't that his argument?
It is his argument, Your Honor, but I think it turns the world upside down, because the city's obligation is to come forward and say, this is our legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for doing what we did. As Judge Johnston said, it certainly seems that promoting your most talented people is a sensible, non-discriminatory reason. In fact, it's hard to conceive of a more compelling criteria than performance as measured by performance evaluations. Whether they chose 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years, Mr. Meltzer would have not qualified, because he never achieved a far above expectation. So these were the best performers. They happened to be younger, but they were the best performers. It was not a seniority system. It was a meritocracy insofar as these promotions were concerned.
Were there people who were not eligible for this promotion because they simply didn't have enough years under their belt?
That would have been the case also, Your Honor. I think there may have been a recent hire or two who would have been ineligible for that reason as well.
And undoubtedly the city was aware that by setting the requirements it was setting, that those people also, if they exist, would have been unable to take advantage of the offer.
That's correct, Your Honor. Again, it was looking to present this opportunity to its most talented people. And with respect to The reason why Mr. Meltzer didn't achieve that level, we've talked about all the factors that went into it, but the biggest hole in his skill set as a lawyer were writing, the writing skills. And as the judge below said, that evidence was really undisputed. If you look carefully at the briefs, there isn't any real effort to dispute that evidence. It came from his peers, his supervisors, from the U.S. Attorney's Office, from the Delaware Department of Labor. It said everything you submitted in connection with your charge was poorly written, grammatically, spelling errors, and so forth, which confirms the city's position with respect to why it is that you weren't far above.
At the time that this program was created, how many employees, how many lawyers were employed by the city?
10,
Your Honor. 10. And of those, how many, aside from the two who actually were promoted, had been working for the law department for 3 years or more?
Your Honor, if I gave you a number, I'm not sure.
Was there anyone correct other than Mr. Meltzer?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. It was maybe five or so.
So there were other people similarly situated?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, as Mr. Meltzer points out, there was a very senior, at least in terms of age, not in terms of years at the bar, member of the department who didn't have good evaluations, had actually had some significant employment issues from a performance perspective. So when you look at the whole law of pretext, and the judge below looked at the Title VII standard, which is applicable to these other various statutes like the Whistleblower Act and so forth, this doesn't even approach a showing where a reasonable fact finder could say, oh, yes, this is pretext. This is a false reason offered by the employer to cover up an unlawful motivation. A reasonable fact finder could not reach that conclusion.
Well, let's go back to the due process claim so I can understand your position. One argument is this wasn't discipline, but the other is there was no denial of due process because of the prior actions of the city that led up to what the city characterizes as no alternative. So is it your position that due process isn't implicated, or that he got whatever due process he was entitled to, or both?
Both, Your Honor, and as was noted earlier, that this was an entirely self-created harm, and that's why I said it's kind of the ultimate bootstrap to create this self-imposed harm, and then talk about the deprivation in that context. It could have put him on an indefinite paid vacation, which didn't seem like a sensible alternative, but clearly he was going to either come back, or if they put him on a paid, he wasn't going to answer the opinion. He just wasn't going to do it. And so they were really faced with somewhat of a Hobson's choice, but to Your Honor's point, yes, I would say on both scores, it was not a deprivation of due process. We, with respect to the First Amendment issue, whistleblower, the Delaware whistleblower statute, there are really two requirements. One is protected conduct, and the other is adverse employment action. We submit that there was no adverse employment action, so that really cuts across all these claims because you have to establish both as a plaintiff. It also touches upon the First Amendment claim, which is clearly precluded by the Garcetti decision. But by the same token, it's interesting because a lot of the protected conduct that Mr. Meltzer alleges that he engaged in predated Garcetti, which was decided in May of 2006, which basically says that an employee in the performance of his official duties speaking to those duties, it's not protected speech under the First Amendment. But
so with regard to the whistleblower, as I read your brief, you basically say all the communications were within the scope of his employment.
Well, yes, Your Honor, that's, so I don't think it's protected. Secondly, under the Whistleblower Act, you either, he says that the judge below ignored the prong of the Whistleblower Act that talks about reporting a violation to a public body, which could include the mayor. Well, the reason we did that is because what he alleged really was he participated in an investigation involving a violation. The court said, first, violation is a defined term, and it wasn't a violation because it's a health hazard, a financial impropriety type of issue. It's a very.
Well, the court also said there was no investigation.
No investigation. Now, with respect to the report issue, which I would agree the court didn't address because I don't really think that's what he alleged, but it's still not a violation. So there are he has two strikes against him on the investigation violation, but the absence of a violation that was reported is equally fatal to that prong of the Whistleblower Act. And the so-called City Whistleblower Act indeed does say that you get the protection that's afforded under Delaware law. So I think the judge correctly decided that. That's a kind of a piggyback on the Delaware Act.
Well, one of the other things Mr. Fasick wanted to talk about but didn't get time was the retaliation under the workman's compensation statute. What's your view with regard to that argument?
Your Honor, on the workers' comp, again, first of all, the absence of adverse employment action is fatal to that claim. Putting that to the side, the court below correctly held that Meltzer was making that report in conformance with his duty as a labor and employment lawyer working in the law department. We have the Kidwell, Minnesota Supreme Court case that is very similar, where an in-house attorney sent an email to management regarding alleged unlawful conduct. And the court held he wasn't acting as a whistleblower, he was performing his duties. The court also, kind of by inference, I think, referred to Garcetti as well. But there's no dispute about the fact that he made it clear that he thought, and I think correctly, that he was performing his duties. So it's not, he wasn't acting as a whistleblower, as the Kidwell court said. Your Honor, I have nothing further unless there are additional questions.
Thank you. If I may address some of the issues that were raised a few moments ago, with respect to the due process, I do not want to belabor that. Simply need to point out that the city, when they made their demand for Mr. Meltzer to secure this opinion, that demand was made a year after Mr. Meltzer had filed his initial claim when he filed his charge of discrimination. Candidly, that's an issue that could have been addressed. The city knew he was going to Operation Fed Up. They knew about his claim beforehand. It could very easily have been addressed in the interim. It simply wasn't. Moving on to the age discrimination, discussion centered on the promotions, would point out there were also other indicia which we raised with respect to age, one being the salary adjustment, another being the different treatment of some of his younger colleagues, one with respect to a brief that was filed in the Court of Chancery in 2003. The other being with respect to harassment complaints that were filed in 2006, where a younger colleague's complaint was fully investigated with a written decision, and Mr. Meltzer's simply was not. We noted that even the Deputy Director of Personnel in their deposition pointed out that Mr. Meltzer's claim should have been treated the same. So there are a number of different factors and different indicia with respect to the age claim above and beyond the promotion. With respect to the promotion criteria, I think we've set that forth in our brief. City has focused on the issue of Mr. Meltzer's writing. However, we have noted Mr. Meltzer's writing did not prevent him from obtaining four post-high school degrees including a Master of Laws degree. Mr. Meltzer's writing has arguably, and the city has not shown, any particular case or matter or issue where the city suffered as a result of his writing. His writing did not hamper his ability to be successful in a courtroom, including cases before this court, cases in the Court of Chancery, which the court, I'm sure, will recognize involve a tremendous amount of very high-level, sophisticated writing. With respect to the First Amendment claim, I believe we've addressed that very adequately in our brief. Our contention is very simply that Mr. Meltzer's speech went outside, insofar as he could, of the scope of his duties as an assistant city solicitor, and most importantly, as not only the Garcetti case is recognized, but also the Thomas case we cited, his actions were in no way commissioned by his employer. He was not commissioned by his employer to go over the heads of the defendants, go to the mayor's office to complain about an internal termination. This was not a termination by the sanitation department or someone else. This was an internal law department issue. So I think we've adequately set forth our position there. With respect to the whistleblower claims, if I may address the city whistleblower statute first, quite simply, the court below really did not address that claim at all. Our position, and what the Superior Court did not address, is the fact that the city ordinance, on its face, a plain reading, is much broader than the state statute. It does not merely piggyback, and cannot, because the city ordinance was enacted in April of 2004, while the state whistleblower statute was not enacted until July of that same year. The city whistleblower statute or ordinance is very clear. Any employee who reports a violation or suspected violation of the law or regulation is protected in accordance with state law. There are no limits on what those violations could be, as there are with the state statute.
But I think opposing counsel made the point that there has to be some actual conduct, a retaliation, before you're entitled to make a claim as a whistleblower.
Well, and Your Honor, I believe that we did indicate the retaliatory conduct, which frankly is tied up with all of these issues. There's the failure to promote. There's the lower salary adjustment. I don't want to be cavalier and simply say it's an amalgam of just bad treatment, but that, I think, is what we're looking at, Your Honor. I see I am out of time, and I apologize, but I thank the court for your consideration.
Thank you. Thank you both. And the court will take the matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess. Thank you.